This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. The clock is ticking. In less than 2 weeks, Detroit's automakers, their suppliers, and the United Auto Workers are hoping to begin the complex process of restarting manufacturing operations. But this isn't just a matter of flipping a switch and watching the line start to roll. Daniel House is a columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News, and he's been writing about preparation for a restart, and he joins us now. Daniel, hi.
Hey, how are you?
I'm all right. Hey, I guess my first question is, what is going on with supply chain to make this possible? Automakers are so dependent on factories, either in other states or China and Mexico. I mean, can the automakers get the parts they need right now?
Well, I think they can, but this, you're right, this is a very complex undertaking that is not really well understood, I suppose, by a lot of people who are not in the industry. First off, you've got suppliers that need to be operating at least 5 days before the automakers begin to come up and restart production. They're looking at Monday, May 18th, which would mean that by next Monday, some suppliers need to be operating to be able to fill the supply chain. That's number one. Number two, you have a lot of different stay-at-home and various other kinds of orders in different states that could be housing different suppliers, as well as three countries in the North American bloc, Mexico, the United States, and Canada. So they have to get all of that harmonized to be able to come back to work. I think the expectation is, as you said at the open, you know, you're not just flipping a switch. The automakers, I think, are going to be starting slowly with single shifts. They are bringing a whole set of health and safety protocols into the plant to protect the workforce, much of which was developed in China and South Korea, also to some extent in Europe. And now they are implementing that here in the United States.
You wrote this week that if the industry restarts and things don't go well, that it could be as damaging as not restarting soon enough. Could you unpack what you meant by that?
Well, I think the biggest thing is that this is all very, very expensive. To sit idle burns, in the case of Ford, $3 billion. General Motors' burn wasn't as much, Chrysler's wasn't as much, but nevertheless, you burn through an enormous amount of money. Stopping and starting also is very expensive. You want to get moving because that's revenue that goes out the door. And once those, the way this system works, once the vehicles leave the plant, they typically are purchased by dealers, wholesalers. And so you want to get stuff out of the plant because you want to be able to get to start to reinflate the revenue line, which has been totally deflated over this last 6-7 weeks. You know, we just got numbers this week on earnings for the first quarter. Now,
right,
the lines had only been shut down for about 2 weeks, roughly, at the end of the quarter. So you see, as someone like Ford, who loses $2 billion, GM was able to eke out a $294 million profit. FCA lost about, I think, $1.8 billion. Now we're looking at a 7 week or so at the inside shutdown in the second quarter. So I think that the numbers for the second quarter for the companies are going to be magnitudes worse than they were in the first quarter. But the question is how quickly they can get restarted. They clearly are going to have a bias towards high demand, high margin, high revenue vehicles, which in this industry, in this town, means pickup trucks and SUVs.
Right, the larger models. What do we know about how sales are going?
I think surprisingly well, actually, all things considered. That's one of the reasons GM did as well as it did in the quarter, is because they were selling a lot of their high revenue, high profit trucks and SUVs before they had to stop production. But even in April, they were selling some of those same vehicles in markets where they were allowed to sell.
So we've been talking over the past few months about how the future of the industry is electric and that many, many automakers are very serious about meeting some goals for more electrified vehicles and more hybrids in the years to come. What do you think this all means for those plans?
Well, I think you have to bifurcate this a little bit. We're working on a piece on this actually this week at the Detroit News, and the bucket has several pieces to it. There's electrification, as you point out. There's also self-driving vehicles, also known as autonomous vehicles, and mobility services like an Uber, like a Lyft, like a Maven that General Motors had, which was essentially a rental car. You get an hourly or daily rental car service. Mobility is having to be totally rethought because people are rethinking whether they want to get in someone else's car, maybe with somebody else in it that they don't know, to go from point A to point B in Washington, D.C. And as a result, people, I think, are pulling back. Automakers are canceling a lot of those programs. So you put that aside. Self-driving, the technology is not there right now, and that tends to be linked to other kinds of technologies. So they're focusing that more on the delivery of goods than on the delivery of people, which leaves you with electrification. This week, the CEO of General Motors, as well as others, said, we are totally committed to our electrification plans. We are going to go ahead with them. I think it's 20 different vehicles that they're planning over the next three or so years. And so I think people are hanging on to electrification, thinking that is going to be a legitimate powertrain option that will be available to consumers, not only in the United States, but in Europe and in China. Probably the regulatory change that's driving that in those markets is not likely to change very much. Although I do think coming out of this slowdown, both in Europe and North America, there is going to be a bias politically and from a regulatory perspective for jobs. So to the extent that these new technologies would negatively impact the job creation in the marketplace, I think that there's going to be pressure for the companies to continue to build ICEs, internal combustion engines, and the typical vehicles that we're used to.
That's such an interesting question right now. What does the world need more of? More vehicles, more innovative vehicles, or more jobs-making vehicles?
Well, it is. And also when you recognize that a lot of the electricity that is powering those vehicles is being generated with burning of fossil fuels.
Right. Daniel, it's been pointed out more than once that this pandemic has exposed certain fault lines in the global economy. When your business relies on other countries with different costs of doing business, different standards for the environment and healthcare, it can be a benefit. But when those systems are challenged, you might get stuck. Do you foresee any long-term reevaluation of how supply chain works because of what's happening right now?
I think the short answer is yes. But I also think that if we go back a few months when the pandemic was really focused on China, I remember having conversations with people at the companies about this and their concerns about sourcing. And you may remember that they really didn't have problems getting sourcing into their various plants in Asia. And one of the reasons was that they have a lot of redundancies built into their system. So if you're sourcing certain components from China, you may also be sourcing from plants in, say, Vietnam or Thailand. So you're in the region and you still have ways to be able to source componentry to be able to continue to produce vehicles because you have redundant systems. You know, one of the things that I've learned over the years is that if you look at the major vehicle producing parts of the world, principally Asia, Europe, and North America, every single one of those places has got one place that is a low cost producer for componentry. In Asia, it's China. In Europe, it's Eastern Europe. And in North America, of course, it's Mexico. And that's partly how the ecosystem works, is you have a regional lower cost producer, not necessarily the lowest, but lower cost producer that enables you to manage cost. And they're doing that around the world. So, but I do think, to your point, I think everybody is rethinking and will be rethinking where they're sourcing things from. When you're getting all sorts of personal protective equipment coming from China, and all of a sudden you need it and you can't get it, that's a problem. And you have people like Detroit car companies that are coming in and repurposing plants that are barely being used, or in the case of Warren Transmission, had just been closed, totally closed,
right,
reopening and retooling them to make face masks, face shields, gowns, masks, and ventilators, which they're doing, GM's doing in Kokomo, and Ford's doing in Rossinville now, come to think of it. So you got a lot of this stuff going on, but I think the fact that the market reacted, I think that partly answers your question, is that yes, people, not only are they going to rethink it, they already have.
I have one more operational question as May 18th gets a little bit closer. What is the size and the scale of the automakers' plans for sanitation and health monitoring within their factories? I mean, are we thinking thermometers at every entrance when people report in for work?
Yes. Some of your listeners could probably find it on their websites. Ford and General Motors particularly, and I think FCA as well, have put together what they're calling a playbook, which is their whole protocol about how they're going to approach safety in the plants, what people are going to have to do, how they're going to, I think, even have to dress. I know that in the case of, I think it was at Kokomo GM, you know, you had to be there with long pants and long shirts, no short sleeve shirts. I mean, there were protocols for how you had to show up and go to work. And that included limited access. I don't expect you're going to get visitors into these plants and people going in. And I don't think media people are going to be able to go in and take pictures and everything else. I mean, you're going to be very controlled about who can be in there and do they pass a protocol every day. Gloves, masks, shields, the whole nine yards. They're, you know, let's just be honest. It does not benefit the union. It doesn't benefit the company to get lax on this and to have to shut down operations if they have an infection. It clearly does not benefit anybody involved in the process. So to the extent that they can mitigate it, they will. And they've done a lot of this and developed this in China and in South Korea, and were able to run in South Korea pretty effectively in the case of General Motors. Ford developed some of this coming out of their European plants and also some of their operations in China, and have been somewhat successful. And I think they feel like they know how to manage it. But we're going to find out here in the next 3 or 4 weeks.
Indeed. Daniel, thanks very much.
You bet.
Daniel House is a columnist and associate business editor at the Detroit News.